Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, about the report he recently published laying out a blueprint for fiscal sustainability. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. It's official. President Trump signed into law a two-year budget deal that ends nearly a decade of attempts at setting tighter spending caps under the 2011 deficit reduction law. The new deal sets a higher bar for both defense and non-defense discretionary spending, with no new caps set to go into place in future fiscal years. Under the 2011 law, spending limits were set through 2021 with automatic across-the-board spending cuts known as sequester if the spending caps were breached. But since 2013, Congress has sidestepped those caps in budget deals that set higher limits or disregarded about 96% of cuts that would have come as a result of sequester. This new deal did the same and for the remainder of the 2011 law's tenure. In fact, it could add an additional $1.7 trillion to deficits in the coming decade, and that is in addition to the roughly $12 trillion that existing law already has us on pace for. One silver lining is that since 2011, deficits have been slightly smaller than expected, largely because interest rates have remained much lower than projected. Congress still has to finish the appropriations process and reconcile existing bills. Senate Democrats announced plans to try to repeal an IRS rule aimed at enforcing a $10,000 limit on deductions for state and local taxes through something called the Congressional Review Act, giving Congress 60 legislative days to overturn an agency rule. The rule was published on June 13th. The $10,000 limit was designed to help reduce the cost of the 2017 tax code overhaul, but high-tax states are opposed to it. A corruption scandal in Puerto Rico that forced the resignation of its governor may require the territory to wait a bit longer for some of its hurricane relief money. Housing and Urban Development recently announced it intends to hold off on some money designated for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands until an unspecified time. Up next, I'll be joined by Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We will be discussing a report he recently published laying out a blueprint to fiscal sustainability. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well. He's a regular contributor on the show. At the Manhattan Institute, Brian focuses on budget, tax, and economic policy. He's also worked as chief economist to Senator Rob Portman, as staff director of the Senate Finance Subcommittee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth, director of budget and spending policy for Marco Rubio's presidential campaign, and he was the lead architect of the 10-year deficit reduction plan for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign as well. Brian also served as the Heritage Foundation's lead research fellow on federal budget and spending policy. In that capacity, he participated in the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, which Bob also participated in. Brian's writings and research have been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, and National Review, and he's also a frequent guest on a variety of national television networks. He has a bachelor's degree in economics and political science from the University of Wisconsin and a master's degree in public affairs from Princeton. Welcome to Facing the Future, Brian and Bob.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Nice to be back.
Well, we're happy to have you on the show, Brian. Thanks for taking the time. This is sort of a follow-on interview to last week's show, where we had Ben Ritz on from PPI about a blueprint that they had put together on basically a progressive budget agenda that was fiscally responsible or fiscally sustainable. And I know you did something similar at the Manhattan Institute. And that's where I wanted to go today. That's the primary topic of discussion I wanted to have. So maybe you can give us a quick summary of the blueprint, what prompted writing it, and maybe address some of the high level goals you had in the report.
Well, thank you. This actually came out about a year and a half ago when I first decided to put my money where my mouth is on fiscal responsibility and draft my own report on a 30-year budget to stabilize the debt. I mean, the reason I did it is because this is, of course, a scary, terrible economic challenge we face. We're on course to add about $80 trillion in deficits over the next 30 years. And I felt like there weren't a lot of plans out there that weren't either conservative dream scenarios that were totally unrealistic, liberal dream scenarios that were totally unrealistic, or just gimmick-filled messaging documents. So I wanted to put something together that was totally scored, no gimmicks, no magic asterisks, and also something that I considered to be at least within the realm of bipartisan plausibility. I didn't want to just do a, if I was dictator tomorrow, this would be my dream. So what I tried to do was stabilize the debt at 95% of GDP over 30 years, which isn't even that ambitious. My thought process was that we're not going to get to balance over the next 30 years. I don't even think the voters would prefer to make all the necessary cuts to get to balance. I think the political system would probably settle for a stabilized debt. And I picked 95% of GDP because that's about what it'll be in 2023 when my reforms would first be implemented. So I wanted to be plausible. I wanted to do 95% of GDP. What that meant was I had to find enough savings to gradually produce 6% of GDP in annual savings within 30 years. If I could cut 6% in programs or tax increases, then I could get an additional 3.7% in interest savings, and we would meet the target. So it really just kind of became a puzzle of how to achieve 6% of GDP in savings gradually over 30 years outside of interest. And I came up with a plan, and it was fully scored, and the numbers added up. And it was actually scored. It was scored by the Peterson Foundation. They actually scored it down to about 80% of GDP in debt because they included some dynamic scoring of the positive economic effects.
And you just threw a whole lot out there, Brian, that I want to take the time to unpack during this interview. But I think I'll back up a step and talk about the sort of the plan generally. You mentioned putting our federal budget on a fiscally sustainable path. By design, is that keeping everything sort of as is in terms of how maybe Social Security and Medicare exists right now, or discretionary spending levels in terms of domestic investment? Or did you have a particular angle in terms of investing in future generations or modernizing things like Social Security? What was sort of the overall primary driver in this plan, or was it just to stabilize?
One of my goals was to stabilize the debt without completely rewriting the entire federal government. That was part of my goal of being plausible. I didn't create a new tax code from scratch, even though I think if we did, it could be better. I didn't create an entire new Social Security or Medicare system from scratch, because, again, I'm trying to be politically plausible, and so I tried not to, you know, be overly ambitious in those areas. But mostly my goal, the goals were to stabilize the debt while being plausible, and also, again, you know, basic things like don't raise taxes too much on a specific group of people to hurt the economy. Don't hurt the bottom 40%. Basically, do not radically go after anti-poverty spending, domestic discretionary spending, the bottom 40% of seniors. So I'll also try to retain parity between defense and non-defense discretionary spending. So when you mention things like investment, I tried to retain room for those. And the way I did this was I basically focused mostly on Social Security and Medicare because they are the ultimate drivers of the 30-year budget problems. According to data from the Congressional Budget Office, and this is, I love citing this, this is amazing. CBO says that we're going to have an $80 trillion deficit added over the next 30 years. Of that, CBO says Social Security and Medicare will run a shortfall of $103 trillion, including the resulting interest costs, and the rest of the budget will run a $23 trillion surplus. Given that, I really decided, okay, you're going to have to focus mostly on Social Security and Medicare. You're not going to get there by wiping out economic investment, infrastructure, anti-poverty spending, even defense spending, which I constrain. You really have to focus on the big drivers, which are Social Security and Medicare, and to a lesser extent, Medicaid. So, I mean, the tiers of reforms I have were Tier 1, squeeze out healthcare inefficiencies, then Tier 2, reform Social Security and Medicare for upper-income retirees, and only after I've done that, try to find other bipartisan spending reforms and other bipartisan tax increases. Those were kind of that was my approach of where to go and how to not try to be balancing the budget on the backs of policies that aren't actually driving the debt.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Bob Bixby and Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We're discussing a report Brian recently published laying out a blueprint for fiscal sustainability. And I want to pick up off of what you just said there, Brian. You talked a lot about putting out a plan that is plausible and feasible and having a certain area of focus to make that happen within the next 30 years, mainly Social Security, Medicare, and bipartisan tax reforms. But one question I had, you talked about stabilizing the debt to GDP at 95%. Does that leave room, does this plan leave room for taking the next affirmative step and making some of those key investments, especially looking at, you know, the future at upcoming generations in terms of the cost burden they might have to share or areas of needed investment in the workforce? Does this plan make that kind of room, or is this the, we're just going to stabilize it and then we're going to figure out what to do from there?
Well, it allows room for those investments within the targets. For instance, for discretionary spending, my plan caps discretionary spending growth at 2.5% per year through 2030, and then 3.5% per year thereafter. There is room within that cap to make investments. You don't have to completely gut the government by having it grow 2.5% and then 3.5%. The reason I have those caps, which again I don't think are that strict over the long term, is it's not feasible to squeeze out other priority programs for 30 years. So I think if you do 2.5% through 2030 and then 3.5% afterwards, there is room for investments, especially if you're willing to actually get rid of some of the lower priority spending within there. Additionally, for what's called the other mandatory spending, the non-Social Security and health care programs, like a lot of anti-poverty spending, veterans, federal and military retirement, student loans, a lot of that spending is generally left on the baseline or slightly below the baseline for the next 30 years. And that's even a challenge because, you know, with the aging workforce, federal and military retirement costs are going to go up, veterans costs are going to go up as our recent veterans get older. So I left room within those programs for reasonable investments, even within the 95% of GDP cap.
I want Bob to jump in here, too, but I have one question that just came to mind based on what you said. You mentioned the cap growth built into this plan. Does the recent two-year budget deal sort of blow that out of the water, meaning would we have to reel that in a little bit to get back on track with your plan?
No, I use the current policy baseline, which already assumed that the caps from 2018 and 2019 would be renewed at roughly the same level. This was one of my nods to feasibility. I began with a baseline that I felt like reflected where we were probably going to be in the next couple of years. Similarly, the reason all of my reforms don't begin until 2023 is I'm also trying to be realistic, in which I didn't want my plan to become out of date a year after I wrote it because it hasn't been implemented already. So I used a realistic baseline, and my plan doesn't need to be implemented until 2023, so everything still applies.
Brian, this is Bob. I'm really glad that you wrote this plan, and I like the fact that you emphasized political feasibility, because it's so easy to write a plan that just says, you know, as you said, sort of take your fantasy plan from one side or the other and put it out there and say, well, here's my plan. But it really doesn't help anybody, because if you're not calling for any sort of compromise, it may give you a, you know, psychic boost, but it doesn't really help solve a problem. So I really appreciate the spirit in which this plan was written.
Thanks. I mean, I think there's so many partisan plans out there, and people have been doing partisan plans for 20 years, and it hasn't moved the ball one inch. So I figured adding one more of those would just be a waste of time.
So we've talked about some of the spending. So let's talk a little bit about on the revenue side. What did you do? What assumptions did you make about revenues, and how did you deal with, or where did you come out with a long-term revenue baseline conclusion?
Sure. As somebody who's personally fiscally conservative, I wanted to get as much done in reasonable spending cuts as possible, but you can't get there. You can't get the debt stabilized by itself with only plausible spending cuts. There had to be some revenues. So what I did was I began with the current policy baseline that assumes that all current tax policies are extended. Under that baseline, you already have revenues go from 16.5 to 18.5 over the next 30 years. So you're already getting a 2% of GDP bump just from things like real bracket creep and taxable retirement distributions. But I needed to add about 1.5% of GDP more. I needed to get us to about 20% of GDP in revenues. And the way I did it was, first, I cut the tax exclusion for employer-provided health care in half over 30 years, which I think is not only good tax policy, it's good health policy. That got me halfway to my 1.5% of GDP tax increase. And then, I think perhaps a little more controversially, I increased the Medicare and Social Security payroll tax 1 percentage point each. Now, people will say, why didn't you just lift the cap? Why did you do this broadly? And it's for a couple reasons. First, for economic reasons, I wanted to keep the tax policies as broad-based as possible. I didn't want to hit one group in the face too hard and distort the economy. And I figured 2 percentage points, people will feel it, but it won't be fatal. Additionally, had we raised the cap, you would have created about a 62% top marginal rate, and under my plan, you would have almost made too much revenue for Social Security and had not enough for Medicare. And so you kind of run into problems there, where you're actually overfunding Social Security and underfunding Medicare. And so a third reason I did the payroll change of 1% each on Social Security and Medicare is because on the spending side, virtually all of the cuts on the spending side are going to be hit by the rich. I mean, I cut Social Security and Medicare benefits for upper-income individuals very heavily. And I felt the non-rich can at least have some impact in this plan. And the payroll tax, I thought, would be at least one small way for a universal benefit to widen it. And then I finally saved a little bit of revenue from getting rid of those dumb December tax extenders and repealing step-up basis for capital gains at death, which, as you know, is where if you die and pass on your investments to your kids, they essentially get them without the tax ever having been paid on the capital gains through the previous person's lifetime, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Doing all of that, I get revenues to about 20% of GDP by 2049, which would be the highest sustained level in history. And that's the plan.
And before we move on, Bob and Brian, I want to jump in here real quick. We need to end this segment, but we'll pick up right where we left off in our next segment. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We've been discussing a report he recently published laying out a blueprint to fiscal sustainability. We'll be back with Bob and Brian picking up where we left off on fiscal sustainability and the blueprint that Brian put together. And if we have some additional time, we'll jump into another analysis Brian put together on how to achieve a grand budget deal. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. We're picking up where we left off on a fiscal sustainability blueprint. If we have time, we'll jump into Brian's other analysis on how to achieve a grand budget deal. And Bob, I want to pick up with something you were about to say, but I cut you off at the end of the segment. We've been talking about the revenue side of this blueprint.
Yes, and I wanted to tie that to the magnitude of the problem, because I was part of a task force led by the late Alice Rivlin and the late Pete Domenici some years ago that looked at this issue as well, and we also found, as Brian just said, that you try to make as many cuts as you can on the spending side and find that you still need to turn to revenues in the end, and that doesn't always please people, but if you look at the magnitude of the hole that we're in, basically, and Brian talked about deficit stabilizing the debt at 95% of GDP, we're about 78% of GDP now, and the CBO says that if you wanted to stabilize there, you'd have to make annual changes of about a little less than 2% of GDP every year, which would translate this year into about $400 billion worth of deficit reduction, either on the spending or the revenue side or both, just to stabilize the debt at 78% of GDP. So you start looking at, you know, where do you come up with $400 billion a year, it would actually get larger as time goes on because you're going to keep up with the percentage of GDP. And it just becomes not feasible to single out one part of the budget or one part of the tax base and say, let's do it all here. So I think it's a realistic approach that Brian has described, and probably very ambitious, even trying to stabilize the debt at 95% of GDP when you look at it in practical political terms.
I actually wanted to jump in with a question about what you were saying, Brian, in the previous segment about some of the tax changes you would make, specifically on the expenditure side with changing or reducing the exclusion of employer-provided health care, reducing it by half over 30 years. And this gets to the plausibility aspect of things from my perspective. How do you get, and this might tie into your healthcare reform, so this might be a good segue into talking about healthcare and your blueprint, but how do you get an entire, industry to move away from either employer-provided healthcare or get the voting population willing to stomach that kind of change? Because that's the, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the biggest form of healthcare insurance coverage in our country is employer-provided.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy politically. You know, even though my plan is what I think would be a feasible plan if somebody put a gun to Congress's head and said you have to stabilize the debt at 95% of GDP, the reality is there is no gun to Congress's head, and they don't really have to do a damn thing they don't want to do. And so it's going to be hard to get them to even do the capping of the exclusion. In fact, look no further than the fact that the House just voted overwhelmingly and bipartisanly to repeal the Cadillac tax, which is kind of a version of this policy that was never even implemented after it was created. That being said, I think, again, if you put a gun to Congress's head and said you have to raise this revenue somehow, I think there's other tax hikes that would be even harder than this. Like, we try raising taxes on low-income individuals by a significant degree, well beyond what I propose, or the middle class. Those might even be worse. At least with capping the health exclusion, you could actually see your paychecks get a little bigger, because if employers pull back a little bit on looking for more efficient health coverage, that could actually lead to a little bit more of your compensation being put in wages, and hopefully that could be done without actually reducing health quality, but in seeking efficiencies. But you're right, nothing here is easy.
And, you know, speaking of it not being easy, healthcare is an enormous issue in our economy, in politics, especially right now during a presidential election and a primary. You know, what's your approach? And I know you've referenced some changes in Medicare throughout this discussion, but give us a broad, big picture look at your approach to healthcare, Medicare reforms. You mentioned increasing the payroll tax for Medicare, but are you making any changes to benefits? What's this program look like? What's healthcare look like broadly under this blueprint?
Sure. Under the baseline, Medicare rises from 2.9% of GDP to 5.9% of GDP over the next 30 years. I cut that in half. I have it go from 2.9 to 4.4. And I do this through two reforms. Number one is I transition to a premium support model, a generous version of premium support, where seniors could shop around for their own private health care with the federal government paying for the premium. Unlike a lot of the more stingy premium support plans, I set the government payments at the median price of the local plan that you're choosing from. Not one of the lowest plans, but you would get a premium support payment at the median price. Even doing that, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would save seniors 7% in costs for the same coverage, and it would save Medicare 5% of costs without reducing quality of care. So to me, if you can squeeze 5 to 7% savings just from choice and inefficiencies without reducing the actual level of benefits, to me, that's a no-brainer. Additionally, the rest of my savings are raising Medicare premiums. Right now, the typical senior only pays about a quarter of the cost of their Medicare B&D benefits. Under my plan, those between the 40th and 80th percentile in post-retirement income would gradually see their B&D premiums rise all the way to 100% of the cost of their B&D. So if you're in the bottom 40% of seniors, you see no change in your premiums. If you're 80% above in income, you pay 100% of the premium. And in between, it's a gradual phase. And this is simply because if we're going to save money from Medicare, it's best to start at the top than the bottom. And there's a lot of seniors that are really wealthy. Overall, I ran the numbers on this. And by 2030, the typical median senior family would have an inflation-adjusted income of $53,000 a year. And they would be paying an extra $1,000 for their Medicare premiums. I don't think that's that bad. And, you know, the wealthier seniors that are making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year might be paying an extra $3,000 a year for their Medicare premiums. To me, if you're going to reform Medicare, I would rather do that than hurt people at the bottom.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Bob Bixby and Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We're discussing a report he recently published laying out a blueprint for fiscal sustainability, and we're now talking about the healthcare aspect of that blueprint. And a question I had, Brian, based off what you just said about the changes in premiums for the Medicare system, specifically on the premium support side, would going that route require any kind of additional regulations or cost controls, especially if you're putting the subsidy or the premium right about that middle of the road mark?
I think, well, under a premium support plan, you would certainly need to ensure that those who are participating in the system are providing a minimal level of benefits. You don't want a situation where the average cost is brought down because all the companies are competing by offering a really bad benefit system. So I think you have to have a certain minimal degree of regulation to ensure that the competing health companies are actually providing that minimum standard that every senior is entitled to. But you don't want to overregulate. You don't want to create a required basket of benefits that's so big and so expensive that you raise the cost for everyone. That's been one of the complaints of the Affordable Care Act, is that the minimum required benefits have their costs pushed up. But I think you do need to ensure, you know, some basic regulation and some basic assurance that all seniors are at least choosing between plans with a minimum level of benefits and coverage.
Brian, the current Medicare system has Medicare Advantage, which is Medicare administered by private insurance companies, and it seems to be a very popular option among seniors. How does that compare to a premium support system? In other words, is Medicare Advantage in effect sort of a pilot premium support system?
It's a pilot system. I mean, it's pretty similar in that you're choosing among competing plans. There's private insurance. I mean, there have been some issues of whether or not premium support could be a little lighter on the regulation. There are issues with whether you're going to be using national or local competing bids between the two plans. There are slight tweaks, I think, between the two systems. But I think overall, the popularity of Medicare Advantage, and its enrollment is growing every year, I think shows that the basic model works. And it's certainly not perfect, and I think you can do better with it. But I think the premium support is, you know, for people who say premium support is this crazy radical idea, I think Medicare Advantage shows that the basic concept behind it, you know, is somewhat workable and already in existence.
This would occur to me, it's like if you did Medicare Advantage for all, if we were thinking about a system that borrows from the current Medicare system that everybody's familiar with, and I know you really weren't getting into that the healthcare reform in this thing, but it just strikes me that sometimes in the political context, people forget that we actually have a part of Medicare, a fastest-growing part in terms of popularity, that does rely on private insurance and is, in effect, subsidized and is sort of a premium support. Because you're right, with premium support, I think having, you know, supported this for a while myself, but you get political arguments made for and against it, people making assumptions about what it is, that it necessarily involves draconian cuts or whatever. I mean, it's become highly politicized.
And I, unfortunately, the end of our segment is fast approaching, so I want to switch gears here real quick, gentlemen, and talk a little bit more about your plan on Social Security, Brian. I know you, again, we've talked about this a little bit along the way, but give us the big picture view of the reforms you see in Social Security, and I want to reserve a little bit of time as well to talk about, you made the affirmative step to discuss what rebuttals might be for your blueprint, so I want to roll into that after we discuss Social Security.
Social Security, I basically borrow from Sam Johnson's plan, who was the chairman of the House Social Security Subcommittee on Ways and Means, and with some tweaks. Basically, Social Security is pretty easy to reform. There's not that many options. Under my plan, we gradually raise the eligibility age to 69 by 2030 instead of 67. We slow the growth of benefits for new retirees in the top half. And there's reforms such as, if you're a married couple earning over $170,000 a year in retirement, not in your working career, but still earning that much in retirement, you're not going to get a cost of living adjustment next year. You don't really need it. If you do those, you shave most of the Social Security deficit off over 30 years. And then if you combine that with the 1 percentage point increase in the payroll tax, which, by the way, because the payroll tax for Social Security ends at about $137,000, and I don't want this tax hike to burden the poor and not the rich, I actually do an income tax surcharge above that point, so it really hits everybody. I think you can basically make Social Security long-term solvent. You know, again, this is the standard way to reform Social Security. Trim benefits at the top, raise the eligibility age, and bring in some new revenues. And don't touch the bottom 40%.
All right, with that being said, I want to jump into the rebuttal section of the blueprint. What were some of the biggest, I guess, bones of contention with your blueprint from either the right or the left, and how do you respond to them?
The right says, how dare you raise taxes? They say that you don't need to do that 1.5% of GDP in revenue. The problem is, I already looked for the most plausible maximum reforms you can get out of Social Security and Medicare. We didn't touch on Medicaid, but I had per capita caps that were much more moderate and reasonable than the per capita caps you often see. I think I essentially maxed out on the plausible savings for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that don't really hit the poor. Beyond that, again, like, if you want to get an additional 1.5% of GDP in savings without raising taxes, you have to basically wipe out the safety net or veterans or anti-poverty spending. And that's just, the political system's not going to do that. They're not going to do that final 1.5% of GDP by eviscerating those programs. So I said, let's be realistic. There's going to need to be some revenues or it's not going to happen.
Okay, we have about a minute or two left, Brian, so I'm going to ask you to do probably something that is near impossible. One thing that caught my attention that you'd also worked on recently was Getting to Yes, a history of why budget negotiations succeed and why they fail. And I read through it. It was really interesting to me. Can you give us a quick summary of that entire report? And the reason why this is... Yeah, I know. It's almost impossible. But the reason why it's interesting to me is because of this recent two-year budget deal where we had the 2011 law that was having budget caps go down. They were going to be too strict for this year. Congress decided to compromise, and their form of compromise for the last couple budget deals has been basically everybody gets what they want, which I don't think is really what's meant in the word compromise or negotiations. So can you give us a quick summary of why, in what you've studied, budget negotiations typically fail, and what could be some things for Congress and elected leaders to look at in the future as a point of success?
Sure. The very quick summary of a 25,000-word report is that I studied the 14 biggest deficit reduction negotiations since 1983. Six succeeded and eight failed. And it basically determined that it boiled down to the same three elements, whether or not you got a law enacted or not. Number one, you need a penalty default. Something bad that will happen, like a sequestration or a debt limit or a benefit cut, if there is no deal. Number two, you need public support for the deal. Even if they're not excited about the cuts, they're sufficiently concerned about the deficit to not rebel. And number three, you need members of Congress who know how to negotiate with each other in good faith, rather than just kind of demonize and play games. If you can get two of those three elements, penalty default, public support, or healthy negotiations, they got a deal every time. If you do not get two out of three, you never get a deal, except for once in 1993 when they were able to overcome their problems because the Democrats controlled everything and there was no divided government. But for 13 of the 14 examples, you need a penalty default, public support, or healthy negotiations. Two out of those three, and you will get a budget deal. Otherwise, you will fail.
And it was certainly unfair of me to throw that on you at the last minute, Brian, so I certainly will encourage our listeners to go find that report and read through it. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We discussed a report he recently published laying out a blueprint to fiscal sustainability and very, very briefly discussed his analysis of how to get to a grand budget deal. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Brian.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. It's been a while since we've had this segment, and it's New Hampshire primary season, so it's a good time
to face this fact. Long-term projections by the Congressional Budget Office provide a timely warning for 2020 presidential candidates. Any ambitious plans to increase spending or cut taxes must account for the fact that our nation's budget is on an unsustainable path. With the debt already projected to rise sharply in the coming decade, elected officials in Washington can't afford to become complacent about fiscal policy, said Bob Bixby, the Concord Coalition's executive director. The last thing they should be doing is pursuing new policies without credible plans to pay for them. Even that low standard of fiscal responsibility still leaves the debt on an unsustainable path, Bixby said. The federal debt held by the public currently amounts to 78% of GDP, its highest level since shortly after World War II. Under current law, CBO projects that figure would rise to over 100% of GDP in just 15 years and 144% by 2049. This projection also assumes many of the recent income tax cuts will expire after 2025 and that appropriation spending is cut well below levels recently approved. Without those assumptions, the long-term outlook would actually be much worse, with debt rising to 219% of GDP by 2049. The report warns the prospect of such high and rising debt poses substantial risks for the nation and presents policymakers with significant challenges. Such high levels of public debt would reduce national savings and income, hurt economic growth, increase interest costs for businesses and the government itself, put increasing pressure on important federal programs, and limit the nation's ability to respond to new and unforeseen challenges. The magnitude of the problem can be illustrated by CBO's estimate for what it would take to stabilize the level of debt over the next 30 years. To reach the same level of debt, 78% of GDP, in 2049 as we have now, it would require a cut in spending, an increase in revenue, or some combination of those two, equal to 1.8% of GDP every year beginning in 2020. This would be about $400 billion of deficit reduction in that first year, an amount roughly the size of federal Medicaid spending and about 35% more than the government takes in through the entire corporate income tax. The long-term outlook not only shows the magnitude of the problem and the urgency for action, but it also provides a roadmap for the key issues policymakers must confront if they want to achieve better results. Those factors include the aging U.S. population and rising healthcare costs. The government must spend more each year just to maintain current service levels for more beneficiaries of programs like Social Security and Medicare. At the same time, healthcare costs grow more quickly than the economy. Tax collection will not keep pace with spending growth as the working age population shrinks relative to the retiree population. Demographic changes also contribute to lower economic growth projections, which are driven by slower growth in the labor force and stagnant productivity. Over the coming decade, CBO projects labor force growth will be less than one-third of the past 50-year averages as baby boomers retire, and productivity growth will be slightly below its average since 1950. This means achieving growth anywhere near past levels will require new policies that increase the size of the labor force and improve productivity. Stronger economic growth would not be enough on its own to solve our long-term budget challenge, but it would help. The CBO's new long-term projections are yet another reminder that the United States must pursue broad budget reforms to protect its future, including its economic strength, and its position of global leadership. And we must deal with the key drivers of future deficits. Current budget discussions focused on just the next fiscal year or even the next few months are far too limited. The Concord Coalition recently released an issue guide for the 2020 presidential campaign. It's focused on the long-term challenges posed by the growing debt. The guide is intended to help voters ask how the candidates plan to put the nation on a more responsible fiscal path, and to find out whether their plans are based on factual analysis. You can find it at ConcordCoalition.org. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.